Mr. Giuliani, thanks for talking with KWBU today. In August, the grassroots organization Black Lives Matter released Campaign Zero, a 10-point policy platform to end police violence. The number one priority on that list is putting an end to broken window policing, which targets relatively minor offenses. Now, in your time as mayor, you and your administration are credited with having success using it. But is it time we put an end to a method of policing that Black Lives Matter says disproportionately affects minorities?
Well, that method of policing led to saving 7,000-8,000 black lives. There's no mayor in the history of New York City that saved more African-American lives than I did. When I came into office, we were averaging 1,800 to 2,000 murders a year, 74% of which were black people killed by other black people. When I left office, we were down to 500. Mayor Bloomberg got it down to 350. 70 to 80% of the people we saved were African Americans, and we saved them from being killed by other African Americans. The problem with Black Lives Matters is, of course, Black Lives Matter. So do white lives, and so does every other way you could describe a human being. Life matter. The reality is that blacks are not systematically being killed by police. Blacks being killed by police are less than 1% or 1% of the way a young black man dies. The other 90% of the way is he's killed by another black man. And if Black Lives Mattered had a truly moral compass, what they would be dealing with is, the two black youngsters who maybe yesterday were shot in Chicago by two other blacks, or the five that were shot in Baltimore last week by other blacks, or the one shot in New York 3 weeks ago by another black. That happens numerous times more than the occasional time that a police officer shoots a black, or even the occasional time that a white shoots a black. White on black crime is minimal. Black on black crime is enormous. So if black lives matter, and they do, it should be devoted to reducing the amount of violence in the black community.
But again, is broken window policing the best way to handle that?
Well, it reduced crime between myself and Mike Bloomberg 85%. So you decide if it's the best way to handle it. It reduced auto theft by 90%. It reduced homicide by 83%. In each one of those categories, particularly the homicide category, the biggest beneficiaries, 70% beneficiaries, were African Americans. If it weren't for broken windows theory and CompStat, there'd be about 8,000 young black men now not alive in New York City that are alive because of the policies that we put in place, myself, and then I could extend that to Mayor Bloomberg. The idea of stop and frisk is constitutional. It has to be based on reasonable suspicion. If it's done constitutionally, it's a perfectly legitimate way of reducing crime. If it's done unconstitutionally, it should be stopped. And I spent more of my life as a lawyer than I have anything else, and I know the difference. And I don't think I had a case when I was the mayor that was ever found to be unconstitutional. We did it carefully, we did it intelligently, and I am extraordinarily proud of what my police department did. And in the course of saving so many black lives, before September 11, I lost 23 police officers. Just recently, two New York City police officers were assassinated in New York City right before Christmas because the mayor of New York and lots of others were making all this noise about broken windows, and the mayor said his son has to be warned about the police, and these two men came up to New York and they assassinated two police officers. You should know that the two police officers were not white. One was Hispanic, one was Chinese. The New York City Police Department is not majority white. It is almost equal numbers, white, Hispanic, and black. So I find Black Lives Matters immoral in the sense that it focuses on the 1% of 1% of the way in which a black youngster will die, and it doesn't concentrate on the other 98%. If it were my child, what I would be worried about is what's happening on the way to school. Is he going to get shot in a drug crossfire? Is he going to be shot by another black because somebody dishonored someone else? Unfortunately, that's the way black people die in America, at the hands of other black people, not at the hands of white people. That is not racist. That's a fact.
In 2008, you sought the presidential nomination of the Republican Party. And here we are again on the heels of an election year. And while you're not running, you've remained in tune with and vocal about the ongoings of the campaigns. So I'm wondering, what's the political environment of today like? Has anything changed since 2008?
Sure, a lot has changed. The political environment of today is hard to read because we're still a year before the election. So if you were a year before my election, Hillary Clinton and I were on the way to the nomination, and the key issue was going to be Iraq. And what happened? John McCain and Barack Obama became the candidates, and the key issue was the economy, which we hardly ever debated. We just talked about foreign policy. So I want to give you a little perspective in that the issue we're talking about today may not be the issue we will be talking about next year as the presidential date for voting is close. Right now, it appears, certainly within the Republican Party and to some extent within the Democratic Party, that the people are fed up with the ordinary, regular politician. So on the Republican side, the majority of the votes go to Trump, Fiorina, and Carson, none of whom have ever held public office. And on the Democratic side, the person surging is Bernie Sanders, who's not even a Democrat, he's a socialist. So the Democrats are voting for somebody who isn't even a member of their party. Socialist. So what I think right now you're feeling is a tremendous loss of confidence that government can solve problems, and they blame that on everybody that's in government. I think that's going to calm down. I think as the American people get to the point where they have to start making actual decisions, just like you do sometimes when you look at five homes and now finally you got to pick the one you're going to live in, a lot more practical concerns start to come to play. And I think you'll see the so-called establishment candidates on both sides do a lot better. I think you'll see the Bushes and the Rubios and the Christies and the Kasichs and people like that start to emerge. But that's my opinion. It could be some other way.
Now, earlier this month marked the 14th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. And you said you felt that the U.S. is in more danger and more denial than we were in before September 11th. What exactly did you mean by this comment?
Well, if you look over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, we've had numerous Islamic terrorist attacks. Some of them are basically not called that because this administration refuses to use the term Islamic extremist terrorism. The attack on Fort Hood, for example, where an army major walked into the base and shot people yelling Allah Akbar, praise to Allah, was described as workplace violence. That's absurd. That was a terrorist attack in the name of Allah, carrying out the jihad that is called for in the Quran and in the Hadith. The murders in Boston, the Boston Marathon murders, were done in the name of Allah. Shortly thereafter, there was a person killed in London with the man explaining that he's doing it in the name of Allah. The number of Islamic terrorist attacks have increased over the last 3 to 4 years, both the actual attacks in Europe and the United States, the actual victims, and in fact, the sophistication of it. ISIS, ISIL, extremely sophisticated. Iran, extremely sophisticated. So I see a world now more dangerous than before September 11. Before September 11, we faced one enemy, Al-Qaeda. We were in a state of denial. Al-Qaeda had declared war on us, had killed our sailors on the USS Cole with no response by President Clinton. But we didn't pay attention. And then we got attacked. Well, the Ayatollah has declared war on us. When you utter words like death to America, destruction of Israel, I'm sorry, you're declaring war on me. When you have on your hands, as the Ayatollah does, the blood of thousands and thousands of his own people, I believe you're a mass murderer. I find the president reaching an agreement with him totally unacceptable. And I don't know what the president's thinking, to be making an agreement with a mass murderer and trusting him to the point that he's trusting him. We can see the first inspection was done by Iranians. They wouldn't allow the IAEA in. This is what they're going to do. This is what they did in 03. This is what they did in 05. I find the naive quality of this administration's handling of Iran to be dangerous and really surprising. Here's a simple rule, and if you read my book, there's a chapter called Stand Up to Bullies. And if you read the history of the 20th century, you can't help but emerge with this view. You stand up to bullies at the earliest possible moment. You don't cave into them. You do not make agreements with mass murderers. You do not make agreements with people who are calling for death to your citizens. You do not make agreements with people who are calling for the destruction of your strongest ally, the State of Israel. What you do with them is you cower them into submission the way Ronald Reagan did with the Soviet Union. And that's the kind of president that I want, not one who makes agreements with a war criminal.
Thank you for your time today. Former mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani, will talk with Baylor University president Ken Starr tonight at Waco Hall starting at 7. With KWBU, I'm Carlos Morales.